Welcome to Intellectual Intimacy, where we're having deep conversations with extraordinary people. This is Cabrina McLean, your host, and on this episode, meet Paul Jackson, husband, father, businessman, and ex-convict. Paul has done something that many of us have not experienced. He murdered someone. Paul is here to tell us his story about his past and where he is today. Here's my conversation with Paul.
Hello?
Hello, is this Paul?
Yes, it is. Is this Cabrina?
It is.
Hello.
I can't thank you enough for your time. So welcome, Paul. Thank you so much for joining our podcast. You have a really interesting story to tell. And I'm just going to turn it over to you. Share your story with us.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me and for giving me this opportunity to share. And I hope that what I have to say helps somebody. I'm not sure where to start. Of course, you know, started long before I ever ended up in prison, but I ended up doing 21 years in prison for murder. I took a man's life. He was my next door neighbor and he was a friend. And he and my fiance at the time, started a relationship, and, I was too immature, too self-centered, and too much of an alcoholic to do the right thing. And I ended up taking his life. And for that, I got a 15 years to life sentence. And in New York, the sentencing guidelines at that time were that I would do 15 years, and then they would decide whether they would let me out or not. And so anyway, I came into prison at 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an addict and an alcoholic. I was drunk at the time of the murder.
Wow.
Well, I actually was drunk in the worst way. I drank so much the night before, and I woke up early, and I was still drunk and hungover at the same time. So I was that ugly, mean, hair on fire kind of hungover drunk, and walked into a situation that I think even sober at that time, I just was not ready to handle, and I did the wrong thing. And so in prison, I didn't look at myself at the time and say, you know, maybe you need to stop this madness, at least, you know, stop drinking. I just continued. I continued to drink and I continued to do drugs. I actually sold drugs while in prison to maintain my habits. My habits were very expensive, you know, they're even more expensive in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't slow down and I didn't stop. I didn't look at the signs. I always blamed others, and in fact, more than once, I found myself, you know, in my cell late at night, and thinking to myself, you know, I'm not a bad guy. I don't understand. How did this end up happening? And you know, my higher power or whatever would sort of give me a mental tap on the shoulder and say, you know, self check here, you know. You're not really a bad guy, huh? Well, you're in prison for murder and you're a drug addict and you sell drugs. So if you brought that resume to a family, you know, out on the street who was actually, you know, doing the right thing and good people, and you presented that resume to them, I don't think they would view you as a good guy. So I'm just like, you know, I think I probably sat there with my mouth hanging open of thinking, oh yeah, I'm not a good guy, you know.
Wow. You know, I want to ask you, that's really interesting. How old were you when this happened? Like when the murder happened and you were sent to prison?
I was 26 years old at that time, yeah.
Wow. Wow. So you were having self-reflection, right? You know, some self-awareness was happening.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is while I'm in prison. Yeah. At the time, there was no self-reflection. It was just me, and it was all about me. And I was very selfish and self-centered and unaware of so many things, you know. But I learned through time and from the School of Hard Knocks, I suppose. So, you know, I ended up doing 10 years in prison as an addict and an alcoholic. And it got worse. It got worse for me. And I, you know, I always felt like, you know, drinking and getting high was my escape. But there was a 40-foot wall around me. There was no escaping that, with guard towers on, you know, intermittently throughout. So there was no escaping that. I never got high enough to escape, put it that way. And really, I was in a prison within a prison, because I was inside of a proverbial prison, but or a literal prison, and my proverbial prison was my addiction. And I thought that was my freedom, but really, it was a far, you know, larger prison than the one I was already in.
That's powerful. That's powerful.
Yeah, so I ended up getting in more and more trouble, which I always, you know, had an excuse and had a reason. It was never my fault. And I eventually ended up in the box for a year for possession and for a dirty urine.
Okay, and what's in the box?
What's so the box is solitary confinement.
Okay.
And I had been in solitary confinement before, never that long. I had it 90 days before that and like a little bit before that for, you know, different things, just trouble that I was getting in, all because, you know, of my addiction and just not taking responsibility. But once I got that year, I finally, you know, when they finally brought me to the spot that I would spend that year, one of the nights early on, I was just sitting there looking around and, you know, and wondering what the hell happened. You know, it wasn't enough for me to be in prison. I had to be in a prison inside of a prison with addiction. So I, you know, kind of set my mind to say, well, let's at least take some time off from doing drugs. Because I enough, even in solitary confinement, inmates can get drugs. It's just amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it is amazing what we'll do, what an addict will do, what a convict will do, and what we'll figure out if we only, you know, put our brains to the positive. And I've heard many convicts say this, and I've said it myself. If we used all this ingenuity stuff that we come up with for a little positivity, it would be amazing, because the stuff we can come up for negativity is just the weapons we can make, the ways that we can figure out how to get drugs and move it around is just astonishing. It's ingenious.
That's incredible.
In that negative way that we manage to think and act, it's, you know, we don't come up with any really good stuff. But well, except for cooking, there are some ingenious ideas.
That's okay. That's all right. So. Continue.
So in that box all by myself with a year to do and 10 years of prison already behind me and another minimum of 5 ahead of me, but it was going to be more than that because they weren't letting me go, you know, not, you know, walk into a board with the record that I had. So it was the first time in my life that I ever thought that, you know what, maybe I have a problem. And I swear in that cell with just me, I could hear a voice say, "Do you think?" And I was like, I looked back at the literal carnage that I had left in my wake. And it was the first time I was like, I did that. I'm not in jail because, I'm not in prison because my fiance had an affair with my friend. I'm in prison because I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, and I'm a criminal. I'm a murderer on top of that. And I'm not in the box because some guy set me up because I pressured him. I'm in the box because I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict and I'm a criminal. And I just looked at everything. And I know that I was probably I'm pretty sure I was standing there with my mouth hanging open going, oh my God. Because I never had owned it, anything that I had done. And it was the first time that I really looked and said, there's no excuse, dude. That's you. That's all you. You own every bit of that. 100%. There's no, this guy did it, or the judge or the DA or my lawyer or this guy. It's you, you. And
no more blaming. Yes.
No more blaming. And I think it was my higher power. Finally, it must have known that this was a time where, you know, this is the only time he's really going to look at this and own it. And I did. And I was like, well, let's try a little bit of sobriety for a little while. And let's not try to chase anything down while we're in here. So I did that year in the box. And I got out and I liked how I felt. I liked the cloud had cleared, you know, of confusion. And, you know, I stopped smoking cigarettes as well. And I got healthier and stronger. So then I was 37.
Okay.
And I got out and I went to a medium. I was more used to Max's. So when I caught that particular year in the box, I was in a medium and I wanted to go back to a Max.
Okay, so there are different levels, and just for folks to know, there's a max and there's a medium. Can you explain that quickly?
Mm-hmm. Right, so I spent close to 10 years in maximum security, and it's different. It's way more real, you know. And I lived in the little time that I was in a mediums, I was like, you know, people that tell actually can live in population where, you know, and sex offenders are actually in population where they're not in the population in Max's because they just happen and they'll be killed. And consequently, they sent me to a jail that had a sex offender program. And it was the most difficult point in my life because now I was no longer self-medicated.
Okay.
So all my psychological defects were raw and wide open, you know, like an open wound. And so now I'm in a jail where officers are used to dealing with sex offenders and petty criminals, basically crackheads. A lot of crackheads were there who just, you know, did year-long bids. They didn't know anything about doing 10, 20 years in prison. You know, but there was a few interdispersed that were like me who had, you know, been in prison for a long time already.
I see.
The cops got to do anything and say anything they wanted to people, you know, and treated them any which way. And I had never seen anything like this. I almost got beat up by them more than once because I'm like, you ain't got to talk to me like that. And you're not going to take my stuff away from me. You know, if an inmate came up to me, we're going to be fighting. It's the same thing with me and you. You're not just going to walk away with my stuff like that because there's some stupid rule. I don't care about your rules. Get out of my face. So they would get a whole crew in. There was more than one. I'm looking back. I'm thinking, man, I was insane, you know. And I didn't know what to do because I wasn't used to this. And it was just a world that, within a world that I just had never seen before. And I just was ready for it. And I realized that, you know, okay, I'm sober now, but I'm insane. I'm crazy. So I remember when I was a teenager, I got in trouble and because of drugs and alcohol. And I was court appointed to AA. So I remember going, being forced to go. And I remember, you know, the 12 steps and all that stuff. And one of the things that turned me off about it was the second step is that, you know, has to do with insanity being, you know, that we admitted that we were insane and couldn't overcome this without some higher power. And I was like, I'm not insane. I don't know what you're talking about. And I realized then that, oh, my God, I am. I'm crazy, you know, and I need help. I can't do this on my own, so I joined a 12-step program.
Looks like I just lost Paul. I'm going to dial back in and get him back, and we're going to continue our conversation.
Yes, we're back.
Yeah, I guess somebody's...
Yes, something happened. It probably, I'm using a recording system, and something probably happened, so I apologize for that. So it was something that I wanted to share with you based on what I just learned, and then I'm just going to have you continue, okay? So what is very interesting to me is that when you were in prison, you were put in this structured environment, and you had some, you were fluid within your own principles, you know, and then once you started getting yourself together, then you would put in an unstructured environment.
Yeah, it was just very different, you know, that I went from, I mean, I guess I was a hardened criminal at that time. I mean, I was used to being around hardened criminals. And in masses, people say what they mean and they mean what they say. And, you know, there's no mincing words and there's no, like, you know, like somebody saying, oh, you know, see that guy over there? Well, he's a snitch. Mm-hmm. Because the minute that would happen, I would be compelled to stop and say, wait a minute. And I would call that guy over and say, come here. He just said, you're a snitch. You know, what is this? Because we're going to get to the bottom of this right now and figure this out. We're not just going to let that fly. Mm-hmm. If you're a snitch, then you ain't going to be here. And if this guy's throwing mud on your name, then we're going to have to address that. But now you get the mediums, and it was just the opposite of that, where people would just be able to say and do anything that they felt like doing. I don't know. It just got to be where, you know, if you were willing to stand up for your own and, you know, like in a max, you better at least be willing to fight for your own. You didn't have to be the best fighter. Mm-hmm. You had to be willing to fight.
Yeah.
So, probably one of the misconceptions, one of the many misconceptions, is like homosexuality in prison. You do somebody play that in prison. Not like, and it's a whole separate world. There's more homophobia in prison than anywhere else I've ever seen. And the line is distinct. If you're going to play that, then your little group over there and you guys all hang out together and don't come over here.
I see.
It was just straight like that. So, and as far as rape was a thing where, you know, it was raping the willing, because if somebody was actually going to get raped and put up a fight, then somebody else is going to step in and say, leave him alone.
I see.
But if they didn't put up a fight, well, then they would just be saying, well, you must want that. So same thing if someone was going to steal your stuff. They may be bigger than you, and you may be outnumbered. But if you put up a fight, somebody's going to respect that and step up and be like, you know what, leave him alone. But if you allow people to just take your stuff, then they're going to be like, listen, if you ain't willing to fight for your stuff, I'm not fighting for your stuff. So you're wrong. But then, you know, in mediums, it's just so much sneak thieving and running tattling, and I guess it's just. The major leagues and the minor leagues, it's a big difference.
Wow. So you're in medium and.
I did almost 10 years in maxes. So by the time I got to, I did my year in the box, I was in prison for over 10 years. Yeah.
I see. And then please take us to the last half of your time there and how you got to where you are today.
Okay. All righty. So I'm in a medium facility and realizing that alcohol, using drugs and alcohol, was just a symptom. And now that I had stopped, really my mind was in the worst place it had ever been, because I was raw, you know, everything bothered me. I was mean to almost everyone. I couldn't keep friends because I was just so volatile and angry, and I just didn't want to be bothered with anybody. I really just, there were very few people that I allowed around me and really had any kind of meaningful conversation with. And I realized that I was sick and that I needed help, and that I was inevitably either going to hurt somebody else or I was going to get hurt, you know, because I was just too angry. And so I went to a 12-step program, and that was the first time that I actually ever really listened to those 12 steps. and really looked at him and thought, whoa, this might be something that could help. And it did, not, you know, but it took a long time, but bit by bit, at least I felt there might be some hope here. There might be something here that can get me through. There was no fast and quick change, no, you know, epiphanic moment where, you know, angels sang and I all of a sudden became this nice guy. But slowly but surely, you know, the anger started to subside. I started learning how to deal with it, you know, and I started seeing my character defects. And these defects never go away. I'm just learning how to deal with them. I'm learning how to deal with me and the world around me. I once heard somebody say that this guy that was very angry had a hard life. He was very angry with the world and just the way things were. And just, you know, about everything was a barb to him. And he climbed to the top of this mountain in the Himalayas to speak to this monk who was so wise about, you know, how to deal with things. And he finally met this monk and he said, what can I do? You know, people are just crazy. And every time I turn around, somebody's doing something that just blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, why don't you try this? Instead of cushioning the whole world so that it's a better, easier place for you to live in, why don't you try cushioning the bottom of your feet? It's an easier place for you to walk in, so that you don't need to walk on soft stuff, so that you can handle it a little bit better. Well, it's why don't you work on you instead of trying to fix everybody else? And bit by bit, I see now more that I tried to force my beliefs, my ideals. I wanted you to be the way I wanted you to be. And if I didn't like it the way that you were, we had a problem. Probably that we just weren't going to be friends. And I would put people on the burn on a regular basis. They would just say something that, you know, maybe I was even in a bad mood and I just took it different that day. And I'd be like, you know what? Why don't me and you be enemies? Because I think I like that better. And they're like, what are you talking about? Well, I don't really like being friends with you because you just seem to be taking that type of shit for granted. You know, you're taking a lot of liberties there. So why don't you view me as an enemy? Okay. And that would be something that I would tell people that was just horrible, self-centered and angry, ugly thing to say, that I want you to be the way I want you to be. And if you can't be the way I want you to be, then we're going to be.
Well, it sounds like you've acquired some coping skills at this point, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the root of checking ourselves.
I didn't realize that it just would have been easier for me to look inside myself and say, well, why is it that I feel that this person is, what is it that they're doing that's really bothering me? I was just very volatile at the time, and I did start learning those coping skills through a 12-step program and started to learn how to not try to fix everybody else around me and make everybody else be the way I wanted them to be, but to allow that stuff is out of my control. I can't control them. I can only control me and how I react.
Absolutely.
And now I've learned that most of the time what I have to say doesn't need to be said. You know, it's certainly the first thing I have to say is most of the time shouldn't be said, you know. And I find myself in through the conditioning of working a program and every day that I double and triple clutch when I speak, because I'll be like, and then the second thing I'll be like, well, and it's, yeah, that's probably not a good thing either.
Checking yourself.
And then maybe I'll realize, you know what? I really ain't got nothing to really say that will help this situation. Then maybe sometimes the third or fourth thing I have to say might help. But really, there's generally nothing that I can say that will bring any enlightenment to a situation. And I'll just have to let it be because it's out of my control and realize that. But I used to be, first thing that came to my mind was just, you know, just fell out of my mouth. You know.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's called being an adult, I think. There are a lot of people who are older, but they're not mature in how they respond to things. So, Paul, take me to the time, like right around the time you were about to be released from prison, right? What happened? And then continue your story for me.
So I eventually went to a better prison, if that's at all. It had outside clearance and had the puppy program, and I was actually part of the puppy program, and that was that was actually kind of scary because I wasn't used to being responsible for anything. And now all of a sudden I had to be responsible for this puppy. And I really didn't realize how scared I would be about that.
Wow.
So I had been to several parole boards already, a couple parole boards already.
Mm-hmm.
And my second to last, so I'd had 19 years in prison, and I had already been to two parole boards. And I'm walking down, and I'm coming up on my third parole hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I've got like 7-8 years of sobriety. And I'm telling my higher power what I think, what I think should happen. And basically my thoughts are, if you're against me getting out of prison, then you're not on my team, and I don't understand this. So I'm basically arguing with my God, telling him, if you're not going to let me out of prison, then, you know, I don't know. I just can't see that we got any type of relationship here because I feel like you're against me. Could you let me know what's going to happen at this next parole board? Give me some kind of sign because I'm dying here. I can't take much more of this. I'm losing my mind. So I get down into the yard, and I'm in the weight pit, and the weight pit is a shack outside. And I'm going to pick up some dumbbells out of a rack. And I look, and there's the end of the rainbow is right outside of the prison gate. That's about 100 yards away. It's right outside the gate. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I look up, and I kind of lean out and look outside. And you can see that the rainbow starts up in the hill inside the prison and then ends outside the prison. So I'm like, oh my God, guys, look at this. This rainbow, look at this rainbow right outside. And they're all looking at me like, dude, have you gone fruity on us? It's a so I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, that's a sign that I'm getting out of prison. I don't know about the rest of you, how you're going to say it, but I'm getting out of prison because God just gave me a sign. So I went, you know, I'm thinking, you know, rainbow God just showed me the sign and I'm getting out and hallelujah. And I go to the parole board and they hit me with 2 years. And I'm like, well, you know what? Screw rainbows and screw God too. But I kind of looked like it didn't take me long till I looked like, well, what would you do after that? If that was the real thing, do you really think that you could handle having messages from God, and how would you interpret anything? And you're way, way ahead of yourself. You can't handle your own life. And you think God is going to tell you that, come on, dude, let's get real here. And I really, you know, it was a lesson. It was a lesson hard learned that it doesn't, God's not going to give you a sign. And even if that was the case, that wouldn't be a very good way to live either, because you're just, there's so much that I don't know. I understand a small fraction of what the world is all about. My view is skewed, and so it just wouldn't work. So then, you know, I spent 2 more years. And when I went to the board the next time, my prayer was, you know, God, if I get out, help me do some good. And if I don't get out, then help me do some good and help me to continue to grow where I am. Mm-hmm. And I sat down in the seat in front of the camera because they don't even see you face to face. They see you through via saddle, you know, through camera.
Okay.
And so the same commissioner that I had 2 years before that hit me was the same commissioner I had. And I was like, God, this is not looking good for the home team right now. And I was like, oh, man. And I was like, well, be ready to continue to grow where you are because you're not going anywhere. And I sat down and I said what I had to say. And I'm looking at her thinking, this is the same woman that didn't want to hear anything I had to say 2 years ago. And she doesn't look like she wants to hear anything I have to say now. But something happened because so you go on a Tuesday and you get your answer on a Thursday.
Okay.
They didn't have an answer for me. They said they're still debating what they want to do with you. And come Friday, they still didn't have an answer. And they said they're still debating. So you got to wait the weekend, Monday, maybe. So, you know, all the legal minds in the program are getting together. They're like, dude, you're going home. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, I don't want to do anything. I don't even want to talk to anybody. All I know is, and I keep turning to my higher power saying, just help me continue to grow where I'm at and help me not jump on this and start having expectations and help me just to help me get through this day with you. And come Monday, my counselor called me down and she said, I don't know what you said, but they changed their mind. They made their decision and you're going home. And I sat down and I said, what did you just say? And I went home and, it was an adjustment. It did help me a lot being in a prison that had outside clearance. You know, had you shifted me from the box to the streets, I would have been a hot mess, you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It definitely was. And, you know, something I've always had and I don't take for granted is my family. Had my parents not trooped and been there for me so much, it would have been a lot different for me. And, you know, there's so many people in prison that don't have that. In fact, the majority of the population, I think that's why they're in prison. One of the reasons why they're having trouble with life is they just don't have family. You know?
Everybody needs a support system. Absolutely.
Yeah. I had that. It definitely made my years in prison easier, better, and it certainly made my transition so much easier. You know, I don't know how else I would have been. Thank God I didn't have to.
Okay.
Had to just get dumped off on the streets. You know, you figure it out. 21 years, you figure it out. Have fun. Be in a couple months. And I got out, and it was amazing and scary, but amazing. And I started working within, I think, 2 months. I got a job.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but the guy was a tyrant, you know. But I had learned how to deal with tyrants, you know, cops that were just tyrannical, you know. So he didn't really have any idea. I just knew how to bounce it off, you know, and just bounce it right back at him without sounding aggressive or anything like that. And just being like, whatever, dude, you know, that sounds like that's more your problem. You want to fire me, go ahead and fire. Other than that, I don't know what to tell you. But once I realized, you know, this guy is really ugly, nasty, drunk, I need to find a job elsewhere. And I found another job, gave him 2 weeks notice and moved on to another job. And from that job, I have managed to start my own business. But in the interim, I of course continue with my 12-step program work and go to meetings and have a support system there. That was just such a huge thing. And it made the transition easier having that group there and just feeling their support and their love and their understanding and them not judging me and, you know, just being there, you know.
That's important. That's really important.
Yeah.
So you have a family, right?
Yeah. So, of course, I found internet dating really fast, and that was like a godsend. It sounds crude, but I was like a kid in a candy store for a while, you know. It was fun and it wasn't fun at the same time. The dating scene is tough, you know. It's very judgmental. But it's also, it was a lot of fun as well, you know. And I had a few girlfriends, but it just didn't seem, I wasn't feeling like I was ever going to have a relationship, but I was just like, that's, you know, listen, what are you going to do? Keep working your program, making money and whatever. But I did want that someone, but I just was like, man, I'm pushing 50 here.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids. And then I had a date with a girl and we met in the park and, she's a music teacher. And then, I play guitar. And so I played guitar for her and we had a 7-hour date and that just
beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, I've had dates that within the first 20 minutes, you're like, yeah. So, check please. And just out the door, you know, I just really, so we had another date and another date and I actually, our second weekend together. Mm-hmm. So we met on a Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and then we stayed on a Thursday night. Then we had a date on a Friday night, and then a Saturday night as well. And I started canceling other dates that I had because I was like, I don't want to go out with this other girl. Not that I would feel like I'm cheating, because I'm not committed to anybody.
Yes.
I just don't really want to. And the other girls got mad at me. What are you talking about? I'm just like, well, I'm being honest with you. I think I found somebody. And but anyway, we were at a college, and she was playing with her, from the graduates that she had from a decade before. They got together and were playing together. And mm-hmm. when they were done, we were sitting in the parking lot having a nice time and getting to know each other a little bit better. And all of a sudden, campus security pulls up on us.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they pull up, I'm like, I mean, I know cops. Mm-hmm. I know most cops are just trying to do their job, but there are those ones that they're super cops and they abuse their authority every chance they get. And I was like, here we go. I could go the whole way. They pulled in like they were a SWAT team. I was like, really? We're sitting in a parking lot. What do you think is going on here? And they're just completely overstepping and overreacting. And I'm just like, so as soon as they asked me for my license, I'm like, oh, I hope I don't end up getting shot. Because tell they're jumpy and scared. Well, they're just jumpy and they're aggressive and they're going to abuse their authority. So they had me step out of the vehicle. So the one says to me, put your hands on the car.
Mm-hmm.
Says, your parole officer has issued a warrant for your arrest. And he didn't even get to the floor. And I said, no, he hasn't. He wouldn't do that. You need to double check that. And he said, well, in the meantime, put your hands on the car. So the convict in me
mm-hmm.
and the man in me wants to tell him, you know what? You need to go F yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to drive away because you ain't got nothing. And you're going to have to prove what you just said because I know that's a lie. Mm. And I know that I could drive out of there, but I'm also looking at the one. He looks like he's getting ready to reach for his gun and shoot. It's two things. I don't want to put Alex through seeing me, get an altercation because I kind of wanted to fight him.
Okay.
I was like, I don't want her to see that. And two, this guy I'm going to have to go for his gun first. That's going to be the first thing that I have to do. Because already I've seen his hand move towards it more than once for no reason. I got my hands on the hood of the car. He's already looking like he's itching to pull it out. And I'm just like, scared to death. So I'm like, okay. So they put handcuffs on me and put me in the back of their and had me sit. And then they go to her and they tell her, you know who this guy is? You know what his past? She didn't know. We had known each other for a week. And so they eventually let me out. They said, well, it's been a mistake. And I so want to get, I'm like, but I end up saying, yeah, mistakes happen, right? You're full of it. Like, do you honestly think I even believe anything that's coming in your mouth right now? And I'm just like, yeah, okay. And they unhandcuffed me. And they had told her, maybe she should go find a nice guy in a bar or something like that. And she's like, I don't need dating advice from you people. So they, unhandcuffed me. And then I walk up to her vehicle and she's like, how could you not tell me? And I was like, how could I tell you?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, listen, the guy that you have what you know for me, that's me. I'm not putting on any fronts, any faces. And there's no fraud. This is who I am. I made a horrible mistake. And if you'd let me explain, I would like to, tell you what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to go home. And I was like, yeah, okay. Good night. And I'm thinking, well, there was a lot of potential there, but that's it for that. There was that inkling of maybe, just maybe, but I was like, yeah, that's over with. There's no woman in her right mind that's going to have anything to do with you, and you can't blame her. I'm like, I don't, she's going to go. There's no way she's turning around and giving me any kind of a chance. Mm-hmm. And I called her the next day and said, can we meet face to face? And she actually met with me, and I told her. We met in the same spot that we had our first date. Which is at the lake at Stewart Park. And we sat there explaining myself, and she heard me out, and she said, okay. And she got in the car and she drove away, and I was like, well, that's probably it. But at least she heard me out, and I still was like, maybe. And she ended up deciding to, you know, give me another date. And here we are 5+ years later with a home and a business that we both run together. And she's teaching still. And we have 2 kids, you know. And
Paul, I have chills right now. That's so beautiful.
I would like to know what percentage of women would have given me a chance. I think it's in the 0.00 category. I don't know what made her. I think she just thought, you know, there's something there. There's, let me see.
That was definitely meant to be. And because we're short on time here, there's some other things I need to get from you, okay? Because you have such an incredible story. So now we know about life before and after prison. I want to know about some of your successes. Like, you have a book?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Okay, so before I went to the box, I had written a book. I went to college while I was in Auburn Correctional Facility. I was in Syracuse University, and I met a professor who was an author. And long story short, I started writing after that, and I wrote a story. It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of messing around with some other stories that I explained, writing outlines. And then I went to the box, and I had this outline of a story in my head. And there I am alone in the box, with a year to do and dealing with just coming off of doing drugs and all this time left in prison. So I start to write this story.
The name of my book is The Diary of Abigail Rhodes and the Secrets of Alonda. It can be found at Amazon.com.
I'll have to get a copy. So tell us, how did you feel as a writer? You know, what was your thought process when you wrote this book?
I can read the words that I wrote and be like, yeah, who wrote this? Because it's, you know, her voice was just so distinctive. And I've written before where the voices of the characters are kind of strong in my head. But her voice was just like overwhelming and domineering. And it was just like almost impatiently telling me, okay, this is what happens next. And this is how you're, and the story just came out. And just even the voicing is not me. It's Abigail Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
And, it tells a story about a young girl who her parents split up, and she ends up moving to a rich area because a friend of her mother's is going to let her be the groundskeeper just to help her out.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to a school where there's rich kids, and she's shy, and it's not going well for her. And she discovers these magical creatures that are living in a cavern beneath her home called Widgets. And the story from there. And throughout the adventure, she not only discovers this secret world, but she discovers herself.
That's fantastic. I can't wait. I can't wait to get my copy of it. And then your life is so fascinating that it was on the Discovery Channel. So how can we find it?
It was a couple of years ago that I did. It's about the area that I live in Dryden. Actually, don't live in Dryden, but that was where I lived at the time of the murder, and that was where the murder happened. And all these tragedies happened in this small little town. You know, some pretty heinous stuff. And so this story covered all the tragedies of Dryden, New York, and my story was just part of it. And so I allowed my story to be told and was interviewed. It's found on the Discovery Channel. And I'm just this one feature that's in the, I think there's 7 different stories, 6 or 7 different stories throughout it.
And you said, because I'm writing this down, what's the name of the series called? or actually, what's the city? Because,
Yeah, I would Google that, and it'll have that in the Discovery Channel of Dryden, New York.
Dryden, okay.
I'm trying to remember the name, because the name is a really dark name that they gave, that they titled the series.
Okay. We can find it, you know. The internet, people, we will find it. So that's good. And
if anyone wants to get in contact with you, I believe you have a blog. Can we find you there? What's the name of the blog?
Yeah, well, you could just find me on Facebook. And I have a page that's devoted to Abigail Rhodes and the book.
Okay, that's fantastic.
And the book, of course, found on Amazon.
Okay, that's fantastic. And it's Abigail Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S is the last name.
Yeah, the family of Abigail Rhodes,
That's fantastic. Paul, I can't thank you enough. I wasn't just listening. I was immersed into your story.
Well,
and I think a lot of people are going to just really learn. I can't wait to get the feedback from what you've shared with us. And I want to thank you. So thank you so much for your time.
I should share more about, how it is now for me? Or did I...
we can. I'm going to pause for a second because I'll edit it back in. So, so tell me about your life now. You know, how do you feel? Who are you?
It's like my higher power has just done so many things for me. And I realized that so often in my life, I was trying to force things to happen and make things happen. And I always felt like I had this door that I had to get through to, to find happiness. And I'm banging on it and pounding on it and trying to kick it in and, using tools and a sludgehammer, just trying to smash it. And finally, I'm just like, oh God, I can't do it. It's just not going to happen for me. And I finally just give up in defeat, and I'm sitting there, and then the door snicks open, and it actually opens by pulling on it. And I never tried pulling on it. And it just, God's, my higher power just swings it right open for me and says, come on right in, after I had tried struggling all this time. And I feel like there's so many instances in my life where I struggled so hard to make something happen, and I just could not force it to happen. And when I finally give up, my higher power is like, okay, you're done, because I'm going to let this happen for you now. And it just falls into place. So now, throughout time, I've learned, like, my business, I kind of fell into what I had planned, and what actually happened were two different things, because my higher power just had these contacts that fell into my lap out of nowhere. And that's how I survive now, and quite comfortably. So I don't have to go job to job. It's just amazing how that has happened. And it's my higher power. It's not me at all. And, I have two amazing sons, and it's just so... Everything changed, when the first boy came. I was like, a coworker said to me, well, now you know what true love is. And I was like, yeah, I didn't know what it was before. And I'm 110% committed, and it's incredible. And we both work programs together, 12-step programs together. And it's amazing how well it works in our relationship, because we've never had a discussion or an argument that sounded like, you know what your problem is? You know what you need to fix? Mm-hmm. You know what's wrong with you? Because our programs don't do that. Our programs tell us to be, you need to fix yourself. You know what's wrong with you? Why are you taking this wrong? Why are you feeling upset? Look at that. Don't look at what the other person needs to fix. You need to fix yourself, because that's the only thing you have control of. And there's so much serenity. There's a lot of surrender and serenity that comes from that. And me realizing I don't have any control of the other person. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm going through some things with family members who are struggling with alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And it's been where I would have asserted myself and came in yelling and screaming and demanding and insulting and demeaning other people for the way that they're living. I'm just like, you have decisions that you have to make. Mm-hmm. And out of my control. And I'm just amazed that my program has allowed me to do that. That these are the words that are actually coming out of my mouth, because I would have said all the wrong stuff and I would have made it all worse. The program has just made it easier, so much easier for me. And, I'm glad that my sons are going to grow up in a home that doesn't have that madness, that has two parents that love each other, that respect each other, and that are constantly working at getting better. And my life is so amazing. I'm 53 years old, and my youngest son is 10 months old, and there's a little regret and guilt, and I feel like, geez, you know, I'm going to be 80 and he's going to be 30. Yeah. But all I have is today.
Yes.
You know, he loves me today, and he's just so, you know, they definitely keep me young. We took him out on a bike ride, and we went down to the lake, and Liam jumped in the water, and then we loaded him back up, and, you know, yesterday we went golfing, and it's just, you know, tomorrow we'll have another adventure, and my wife and I are going away for our anniversary, and we're going to go mountain climbing, and there's just so many things that I would have never done, even if I didn't go to prison, just as an alcoholic and a pothead, I would have talked about them, you know, going skydiving. Well, I've actually been skydiving, you know, the just trailblazing and the bike riding and the exercising and the, you know, having the kids and golf. I would have sat there and talked about it or brooded about it and felt like I did something. But now, you know, with this life, I'm actually living it, you know, and I'm living life each day. It's like, this is my last day, you know, and I'm trying to eat up as much as I can and do all the good that I can. And I hope I can, you know, help others. And I try. That's part of my program is built around you know, focusing on others, not focusing on your own problems. The best way to solve your own problems is to focus on somebody else's and how well that works. And I hope I can do that more and more and better every day. Just being there, I think, is a huge part. The availability is the biggest part of being able to help others and listening and being able to listen without judgment.
Yes. Well, if I had to sum up what I just learned from you today, it's the power of having the courage to tap from within. You grew in your emotional intelligence, your self-awareness, your social awareness of how you impact people. You started holding yourself accountable. Your 12-step program has really helped you lead the way, and now you're living your life in love. So it's just beautiful. It's just such a powerful story. I can't thank you enough. If I'm asked to bring you back, would you be willing to talk to me again?
Sure. You're a great host.
Thank you. Well, it's just been a pleasure connecting with you, and
I can't wait to get the feedback and share it with you.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks again, Paul, for joining this podcast. You can find Paul's story on the Discovery Investigation series, Dryden's Dark Soul, Episode 3. And again, his book, The Diary of Abigail Rhodes, can be found on Amazon. Look for Paul on Facebook and buy his book. So, thanks again, Paul. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks for tuning in. And please don't forget to subscribe to my podcast. You can find me at Coach Cabrina. The series continues. Tune in to the next episode. Thank you for listening.